Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project, and I'm your host, Tanya Baker, at the NWP in Berkeley, California. Today is August 14th, 2015, and tonight we're talking with Amy Clark about Talking Appalachian. Amy is the founding director of the Appalachian Writing Project and co-editor of Talking Appalachian, Voice, Identity, and Community, a book that has been called the most comprehensive, accessible study of Appalachian language available today. Amy is a native of the Central Appalachian region, and she has written about it in publications like the New York Times, Harvard University Press blog, and on our own National Writing Project website. The book also details important research on the influence of dialect in writing, conducted by a team of PCs with the Appalachian Writing Project. Although tonight's show is pre-recorded, if you are listening to us at airtime, we invite you to join us in the chat room, where we will be posting links to materials related to tonight's program. Welcome, Amy. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's so great to finally get to talk to you about your work and the work of your writing project. I've been looking forward to this interview for a really long time.
Thank you. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk about my region and our dialects.
So let's start by introducing you and your relationship to the study of Appalachia and Appalachian Englishes. Your book opens with notes from both you and your co-editor about your personal histories and your interest in Appalachia and the study of language and language diversity. Could you share some of your Appalachian story with our listening audience?
Sure. As I say in the book, I was born into three living generations in rural central Appalachia in Lee County, Virginia. And we all lived just a couple of miles from each other. And I think that's where my love of our spoken dialects is rooted, because I lived among my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents for a great deal of my life. I didn't lose my great-grandmother until my early 30s. And their dialects, for the most part, had not been altered or leveled by extensive formal education or travel. So all my life, I was constantly hearing these rich expressions and pronunciations that I now associate with something Georgia Ella Lyon calls the voice place, which is the title of her essay in part two of the book. My great-grandmother would say counterpin instead of bedspread, and she would tell stories about haints in the hollers. And then when I was in church three times a week, I heard sermons, because the King James Bible was the primary text of the church, I heard sermons in Appalachian dialect infused with bits of Elizabethan English. I didn't see voices like mine in print, though, until college, where I took a class in Appalachian prose and poetry. And my professor assigned an oral history project. I now teach this class, and I do the same project. But he told us to go home and record a member of our family instead of doing a traditional literature paper. So I went home to my great-grandmother with my recorder, and I captured her stories in her voice. And then in the act of transcribing her words and the syntax of her sentences, that allowed me to hear the poetry in her dialect. And this is the voice that I was reading in the writing of Lee Smith and James Still, Harriet Arnaud, those authors assigned in the course. Everything I'd heard on television or even among my friends about how ignorant we sounded was diminished by then. It was a turning point for me in realizing, and I'm quoting Linda Scott DeRozier here, that I was carrying heritage in my mouth. And that's a lovely quote from her book, Creaker.
Amy, listening to you talk about how you grew up and about your grandma, this gives me goosebumps. I grew up very similarly in Maine, in a very rural part of Maine, and wish I had had a similar experience as an undergraduate. So it sort of makes me miss home, to tell you the truth.
Oh.
So thanks so much for telling that story. Your book is divided into two parts: an academic study of language diversity, really, in Appalachia, and a section that celebrates literary representations of Appalachian experience and language. I wonder if you'd like to sort of jump to the second part first and share an excerpt or piece from the second half of the book that you really like.
Yes, in the second half of the book, we use fiction, poetry, and essay to offer our readers interpretations of what it means to be a speaker, which is something that gets lost in scholarly discussion. And mm-hmm. Silas House, who's a novelist, an essayist, and a playwright at Berea College in Kentucky, wrote an especially moving essay just for the book that he begins with a memory of a substitute teacher who ridiculed him for how he pronounced a word, a three-letter word. And that memory haunts him well into adulthood. So I'm going to start reading from his essay, In My Own Country. He's in class, and she has asked a question about why people shouldn't touch cave walls when they're spelunking. I raise my hand as I can't stand the silence stretching out across our classroom and because I don't want her to think we're stupid. Yes, she nods to me, more exasperated than glad that I'm willing to answer. You shouldn't touch cave walls because the oil from your finger could stop a stalactite from growing. The substitute looks like she might laugh, and then she looks mad again. Your answer is correct, but if you want people to take you seriously, you must stop talking like a hillbilly. Now, I have been taught that this word is acceptable only when another hillbilly is using it. This woman is not my people. It's oil, she enunciates, not all, and it's finger, not fanger. That's the way I talk, I counter, sitting up straighter in my desk, defiant. You talk wrong, she mimics, and she laughs to herself. The whole class is silent. No one is laughing with her, and the shame rushing over me isn't because she's embarrassed me in front of my classmates. To them, she's only embarrassed herself, but because I know that really she's making fun of my people. And that excerpt resounds with me as an Appalachian and as an educator, because how we talk about our language matters just as much as how we use it. And he goes on later in that essay to say, and he comes back to that three-letter word when he's recording one of his novels and the director or the producer asks him to say the word again in a more standard way. And he has to take 24 hours to think about it because it's such a, you know, it means that, you know, how he's pronouncing that is loaded with, you know, ramifications about whether he's selling out or staying true to who he is.
Right.
And there's a quote by Georgella Lyon in part two of the book. It was hard for me to choose just one, where she says, the quote is, where you're from is not who you are, but it's an important ingredient. I believe you must trust your first voice, the one tuned by the people and place that made you, before you can speak your deepest truth. And all of the authors in part two talk about that struggle of being true to that voice in the face of prejudice.
Both of these examples are so powerful to me because I feel like as a young person, I had none of that pride or defiance that, that comes up again and again in these essays. That's so powerful.
They are.
Thank you for sharing those, Amy. Let's talk a little bit more then about what Appalachian Englishes are, and see if we can understand a little more about dialect English and Appalachian English in particular.
The history of the dialects is complex, just like the region is very complex. I think, and Silas says there's beauty in that complexity. It's hard to define them exactly because the dialects change as people move in and out of a region, and they're so old, the history, you know, is so rich. But I find it fascinating that so many of the old features can still be heard. We have a chapter by linguist Michael Montgomery, who's done the most extensive research on the influence of the dialects. He was the first to build a scholarly bridge between Appalachian dialects and the Scots-Irish. And he says that most of the usage can be traced to the colonial era when Appalachia was populated primarily by German, Scots-Irish, and English settlers from around central Pennsylvania down to north Georgia. And you can still hear grammar features. I'll just give you some examples. You know, and I hear these with my students.
Right.
Like they for their or leveled verbs like drawed with an ed for draw, you know, putting ed at the end of irregular verbs. Those have connections, direct connections to the Ulster Scots in the English. And there are words in still in use like ewens or y'all. They'll, in Pittsburgh, they'll say yens. Piece for distance, poke for paper bag, that's Scottish. Pronunciations like warsh for wash, holler for hollow, or halt for help, those can all be traced back to early settlers and beyond. And that's just a typical, I mean, there's so much to be said about the history. I mean, those are just a few examples.
I know it's your life work, and I keep saying it's just so amazing, but it's just amazing to think about the richness and depth of the history and how that can be seen as a deficit. Remarkable. And throughout the book, there is an argument, it seems to me, that's made that language variation and vernacular dialects are not only not wrong, but they're actually really valuable and worth preserving. What are some of the reasons that we should value vernacular dialects and maybe Appalachian dialects in particular, and maybe even be interested in preserving language variety?
Well, I think the act of preserving a dialect really comes down to a personal choice. But that's one, what we keep saying in the book is that's something that everyone should have the right to make for him or herself. And that's not a new idea. That was discussed in education back in 1974 when the 4Cs published Students' Right to Their Own Language. I mean, it says the same thing. But it's still controversial. And I'll talk about this more later in the interview. But every dialect has importance for a speaker, and for that reason, we have to think carefully about the language we use, particularly as educators, to describe a person's speech. There's a lot to learn from history. There were early attempts to eradicate languages and dialects. We talk about this in the introduction. In this country, and it comes down to the fact that negative expressions about dialects are linked to prejudices about the people who speak them, prejudices about race, or in the case of Appalachia, class. We know a lot about early dialects from written accounts like letters and journals and novels. Today, how much is being preserved really depends on the age of the speaker, how much has been leveled due to formal education, a career, travel, because we know that the more a person comes in contact with other people, unless they make a conscious choice not to change their speech, it simply happens.
Right.
But they are being preserved in this rich body of literature and music that the region continues to inspire, you know, and a sampling of that is in part two of the book. So when I'm talking about this kind of thing with teachers, I use Langston Hughes' poem, Mother to Son, and there are all kinds of poems that you can use for this exercise, but I love this particular poem. I love the voice. The way she speaks says so much more, I think, than her advice. And so what I do is I have teachers rewrite the poem in standard English and remove all traces of vernacular dialect, and then we read both versions, and you instantly hear what's lost. It's not,
right.
not the same poem. It's not the same person. And that's a good way to illustrate just one of the reasons why dialects can be so significant.
That's a really powerful learning experience for teachers, I would think. What happens when you do that in a workshop or when teachers sort of hear that, have that experience for the first time?
It's a simple exercise, but it really is powerful. I don't think I've had anybody disagree that it's significant in showing, you know, what is lost. And because we tend to privilege those kinds of texts over student writing, they you know, for the first time they're thinking, well, that's what's happening with my students. You know, I'm telling them that it's wrong, that it's wrong, that it's wrong, what is being lost in that process. And there's a time and a place for every kind of dialect. I just think it's a great way, you know, just like going back and transcribing my great-grandmother's speech and hearing for the first time what was in her voice. I think we take,
right.
We're so institutionalized to think a certain way about language, we take that for granted.
Yeah, I think that's true. It reminds me of, I moved to California when my daughter was in third grade, and they read Make Way for Ducklings in their third grade reader, and she came home and said, oh, can you come to school and read Make Way for Ducklings? Because my teachers in California don't know how those characters sound.
Oh.
That doesn't sound right. This, seriously, Amy, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through this interview. It's making me very homesick.
Oh. Well, if there's a strong connection, I mean, that's what Georgella Lyon says in Voice Place. It's almost a spiritual connection for some people between home and voice.
It's so interesting to know it and maybe know it in your bones or in your voice, but then to have it explained and to talk about it's a really interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Nancy Hayward's essay, Think Locally, which I think helps readers to understand language as not as a sort of independent entity, but as part of a shared practice, the shared practices of a community. I wonder if you could tell us about some of the studies she references.
Well, she talks about something called a community of practice, and that piece says so much about the why behind language use, which I think is really important because a lot of the assumptions people have about vernacular dialects, a lot of the misconceptions, really just comes from a lack of understanding. So I think this really helps us to understand in part why people speak the way they do. But a community of practice refers to the way people use dialects as a part of a mutual engagement in some activity or enterprise, and they use a shared repertoire. She discusses studies of two groups in North Carolina, two groups of women, and also a group of police officers in Pittsburgh using this community of practice model. And Pittsburgh, by the way, shares a similar linguistic history with Western North Carolina because they have their similar language features. But the groups are different in the types of Appalachian dialects they use. There's a group of women called the Porch Sitters who use African-American vernacular English in Western North Carolina, while the officers in Pittsburgh speak what is known as Pittsburghese. But what they have in common is that the language is determined by their identities in a particular sociocultural context. So contrary to the idea that one's dialect is determined just by ethnicity or just by region, what she says is, and I'm quoting her here, that their participation and identity constructions in a particular community practice determine in part why they speak the way that they do. It's like I'm a member of a quilting club, and when I go, you know, once a month to the quilting club and we quilt, you know, it's a mutual engagement in an activity that may determine how I speak, you know, in that particular group. So this is why we say Appalachian English is instead of Appalachian English, you know, as a singular homogenous language.
Regular. It's just like a really powerful construct, too, for allowing people to have pride and ownership in their language usage in a way that, in a way, it's not, you haven't been determined by where you live, but by many choices you make, you then choose to participate in this way. That feels like a really powerful reconstruction.
It is powerful. And when you start to think about all this, particularly as a teacher, it really makes you rethink how we tend to just, you know, all that's diminished when you simply say, oh, that's incorrect. You know.
Yes, exactly. And I think you just made the great transition to the next part of our interview, because I would say that as well, that thinking this way about language and language use has real import for what we do and what we say as teachers. You wrote in the book a lot about a sort of trajectory of your teaching career to being the teacher that you are now, especially the writing teacher and the language teacher. So I wonder if you would be comfortable if we started just talking about where you began as a public school teacher.
I started teaching in the public school system in Virginia a little over 20 years ago, and I came out with my master's degree in literature, my undergraduate degree in literature, and started teaching special education. Because that was the job I was given, and I went to school. They trained me as I was in that particular position, and that was a wonderful experience. I learned so much from those students. They really taught me how to be a teacher.
Right.
And then I moved into the English classroom from there, and I realized in my 4 years that I did not feel like I knew what I was doing. I was enthusiastic, and I tried to be innovative, but I really had no formal training in writing pedagogy or writing theory. That's not so much the case now in college programs, but I know that in mine there was no formal training in how to be a writing teacher. In my graduate program, I didn't have that training. So when I got a job at the college level teaching composition, I was asked to start a writing project. That was back in 2000. And in the process of doing that and getting that off the ground, I realized I really need to go back to school. And so they gave me a leave to go back and complete a doctorate in writing pedagogies, rhetoric, and applied linguistics. And that research during the doctorate led me back to my community and our dialects. You know, I was able to look at them through a researcher's eyes. And I saw the need at that point to address it with the work of the Writing Project site, you know, there in the heart of Central Appalachia where I was born and raised. I saw so many connections that could be made in what we were doing. So when I returned, you know, I came back really enthusiastic about, you know, multiple literacies, this home-to-school connection, and particularly dialect.
Yeah, but so lucky for us in the Writing Project to have you in our network and to have you connected this your home knowledge and your education in this and public school and the university all in this way. I know you spent a lot of time talking about the value of contrastive analysis, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that as a sort of theory of action around this work.
Well, I learned about contrastive analysis from Rebecca Wheeler and Rachel Swords. I met them at an NCTE NWP conference or annual meeting. They did a workshop on this, and they've authored a couple of books on code switching. And they had conducted research using the contrastive analysis method with elementary students who spoke AAVE varieties in Eastern Virginia. They had been scoring below their peers on benchmark tests, and they suspected that maybe their spoken dialect was having, you know, something to do with that. And they had dramatic results with this method, and I thought that can be applied directly with Appalachian students. So I wanted to try it.
That's great. Can you tell the audience about the sort of big idea of this instructional idea?
Right. Well, it involves a two-pronged approach. One part of that is that you change your language of instruction. You move away from binaries like this is the wrong kind of English, this is the right kind of English, this is incorrect, this is correct. That's hard to do as a teacher because that's something that we, you know, that's so a part of our vocabulary sometimes.
Right.
But you move away
right.
from that and you use age-specific descriptions like home language and school language or formal or informal. And then the second part is that if you have a particular pattern that's emerging in student writing, you take that pattern and you contrast the grammar of a student's spoken dialect with that of formal English and teach her how to shift from one to another in a particular context and for a particular audience. That way, the student still has a choice about keeping his or her home voice. You're not asking them to erase it. Because when we say it's wrong, we're saying your right. parents are wrong, your community is wrong, everybody's wrong. And that, you know, how confusing is that?
Right.
I have a terrific team of teachers who agreed to take this on. And I said, you know, let's do a study. Let's do a study in our, you know, let's do a study and let's see if there's any anything happening with dialect in our students' writing, and let's try this method. We conducted a study at the middle, secondary, and college levels based on what Wheeler and Swords had done. And I even talked with Rebecca Wheeler about her research, and she sort of gave me some guidance. And we wanted to see if dialect influenced student writing and whether or not this method could improve their ability to shift into standard English, particularly on assessment, because, you know, like other states, Virginia's high-stakes tests are, you know, they're quite stressful for teachers and students. So the methods changed based on the grade level. So, for example, at the middle level, I have a TC named Elizabeth Phillips. She's an award-winning teacher, wonderful presenter. One of the things that she did with her students was they carried monitor booklets with them everywhere. You know, if they went to a football game or they went to Walmart or wherever, and they listened to the kinds of things people were saying, and they tried to capture vernacular speech and write it down in their monitor books. And they brought those back to class and used those as examples when they were learning how to code switch. They would use those patterns.
I love
the result. Isn't that great?
Yeah, I mean, I love the description too of the place that they found and shared with each other, places that were rich in examples.
Right.
Like at the Walmart, for instance.
And of course, at the secondary level, my TC, Grace Bradshaw, she used the example I talked about earlier, having students take poems written in a vernacular voice and standardize
right.
them and compare. And our results were pretty significant. One of the outcomes was that, you know, TCs reported that the student attitudes about writing and grammar instruction improved in all of the classes. The writing environment changed. They didn't come in saying they hated writing. They were eager to talk about, you know, what they were finding and what they were learning. They took pre-tests. We used a retired prompt from a state-mandated test, and we did it at the beginning of the year and then again at the end and compared the scores. At the middle school level, there was a 72% increase in the scores compared to the control group, which had a 9% increase, and some improvement at the secondary level at 26%. We did not see a great deal of improvement at the college level, but there were some differences in the way that particular study was carried out. And we also think that by that age, attitudes about language are pretty well determined. She did say that changing language of instruction, with college students does make a difference when you do go from the right-wrong binary to, you know, this is your spoken voice, this is a voice that you should be using in your writing. That does make a difference. And so this is important because teaching students, you know, nobody taught me about my linguistic history. I never knew why I spoke the way that I do. I just got from television and everywhere else that we were just country bumpkins. You know, that's what I always
right.
assumed, that we were just country bumpkins who talked this way. I didn't know about all the history behind it. So teaching students about their linguistic histories is really the first step. And talking about the fact that there's nothing wrong with it, and that's key. But teaching them about the awareness of audience and the need for clarity is really important, so that it's not about change the way you speak so people won't make fun of you. It's about shift so that people can understand you no matter where they're from, shift so that you're meeting the needs of an audience at a given time. This, and even this is, and I get into the book a little bit, but even that's a little bit controversial because people talk about power structures and so forth, but it accomplishes what we want to teach even as we send the message that their homes and communities are just as important as the institution, and it empowers them to embrace that and give them the choice.
Indeed, and it seems like particularly the example that not only helps students see that there's nothing wrong with their language, but that actually it's rich and interesting. Like those examples where you change a poem that is written in dialect to standard English and talk about what's lost feel really powerful, especially for the attitudinal changes for students.
It's
amazing work.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think the teachers were really changed as a result too. They were sold after that year, and I think all of them are still incorporating. Well, one retired, but the other two are still incorporating this method into their instruction.
What are some of the things they say about the experience? Is it mostly that it works, or were there other things about attitudes or relationships that were important as well?
As I said before, they were amazed at the difference in the way that people and the way that their students responded. Because really this was the first time that they were that their voices were invited into the classroom,
right.
Actually invited and privileged as part of the instruction instead of, I've known teachers who have just this horrible knee-jerk reaction to, and grammar patterns, I think, grammar patterns carry the biggest stigma when it comes to vernacular dialect. That's the thing that people have a reaction to the most is the grammar. You know, they can forgive accent, but when you use non-standard grammar, that tends to. But even those patterns, again, some of those patterns are very old, and there's a reason why they're there in a student's speech. So, in the course of talking about this, I think that was one of the key things for them was that. Giving students this knowledge and understanding rather than just saying, because if you just tell them it's wrong, don't do it, well, that just gives them a reason to do it, to keep doing it. But if you say, there's a reason why this pattern exists, here it is, that's really cool. Let's talk about maybe what you should do when you're in another situation where someone may not understand that, and you'll need to be clear. So I just think overall they were, I don't know, I keep coming back to this, but I think just the environment changed. The classroom environment changed.
Yeah, I would think it would have to in a really sort of significant and powerful way. Amazing work. I wonder, as you know, we know that lots of people listen to NWP Radio, but we sort of consider our home audience, the Writing Project Network, and the teachers and Writing Project directors within it. And so I was wondering if we could spend a few minutes at the end of this interview talking about thinking about incorporating this kind of work into Writing Project work.
Well, I know it's changed the way I teach every class, and I know it's changed the way our site thinks about writing and language. Again, where we're situated means that we can't ignore the importance of spoken, of dialect here and its impact on our students. And a lot of us were born and raised here, so we understand it. And many of us can still speak the dialects that our students use when we choose. We knew that this would take us down a different road, and we knew that it would get a lot of attention because everyone has an opinion about Appalachian speech. And I'm not going to sit here and say that everyone agrees with this approach, or that everyone agrees with, you know, the idea that you should keep it or give students a choice to keep it. But we did develop in services based on the work that we use, and they've been well received at every level. We use we use this work in our young writers camps. You know, we're very sensitive to the way that we talk to kids about writing. I think it infuses everything we do in some way. I consult with colleges and universities now who've experienced problems with students leaving the education program because they have differences with their professors because of their dialects. So these concepts work at every level, no matter what dialects exist in a community, because little kids and big kids alike will shut down if they're taught that their home speech is wrong and there's only one right kind. And I would say to another writing project that may want to do such a do something like this that embraces language, that you should first know as much as you can about the dialects of your communities, the histories of those dialects, the features of grammar, vocabulary, and pronunciation, which is the key component. You know, when I wanted to do this, I couldn't find one place where there was everything I wanted to know about Appalachian dialects, and so that's why Nancy and I decided to do the book. We just didn't find one. You know, that's what they say. If you can't find a book, write it. So, you know, because the chances are great that in most schools, students do not know why they speak the way they do. They've never been told, probably because a lot of people don't know themselves. And if someone doesn't tell them, then they will internalize the attitudes of mainstream America, which tend to be negative, particularly if it's a stigmatized dialect. So you find literature, you find film, and scenes that illustrate empowering examples of the dialect. You design lessons that teach students, you know, in what situations vernacular dialects would be appropriate, what situations would be better for formal varieties. When I'm sitting on the porch with my 81-year-old grandfather, I don't want to sound like Dr. Amy Clark. That would destroy our relationship. I mean, he's a very intelligent man. But why do I need to, you know, why do I need to sound like a professor with him? It is so wonderful to be able to just fall back into that comfortable voice. You know, I say ain't. You know, I bend the rules of standard English. And my husband is from Northern Virginia. And so, you know, he's always amazed when I'm around my family. He's like, it just comes on. You know, it's like a light switch. It just comes on. And that goes back to community practice. That's how we communicate with each other, and it's so much more than just you know, being formal or being informal. There are political pitfalls. There will be people who are not comfortable with this idea. I was warned about that in the beginning. But we really didn't have any problems. You know, a couple of the teachers did say that there were some prickly situations in discussions about language that they had to walk through carefully. Language is political, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I still come back to another great quote by Georgella Lyon in her essay. She says, if a person's experience of the written voice confirms her first voice, both in what she reads and how she's taught to write, then her growing literacy will be fed by strong cultural roots. And I think that's so powerful when you're thinking about this topic. And, you know, I just come back to that again and again as the reason why I do this.
That's a really lovely way for us to wrap up the sort of formal interview, Amy. Thank you so much for... Thank you for the great work that you're doing in your place, and as well as for beautiful book and for talking to me about it today.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder, we do have a few minutes, so I don't want to cut you off if there were any other things you wanted to say about the work or your writing project or what's next, what we should be looking for.
Well, I'm just, you know, there's an entire chapter about the writing project, the research team, and their work. It's called, I think, Voices in the Appalachian Classroom in the book. And it just came out in paperback now, so it's way more affordable, which is nice. It's with the University Press of Kentucky. And we do have a Facebook page called Talking Appalachian, where we, you know, provide updates about dialect and, you know, interesting tidbits about language and the authors in the book. And the Appalachian Writing Project also has a Facebook page, and so there occasionally there are things there about the topic as well. And so those are places where listeners maybe can follow up if they're interested in finding out more.
I'm so glad I should have done it. I'm so glad that you gave the information about the book. And since it is newly out in paperback, could you tell people one more time where they could find it and the title and the publisher?
The publisher is the University Press of Kentucky. And, again, it was re-released in paperback. I think you can find it, you can certainly order it through the University Press of Kentucky. If you use the code A for Talking Appalachian, as in for Talking Appalachian, 3, STA3, I believe you can still get 30% off the price of the book. I asked them to do that because I just felt like, you know, teachers especially needed a little bit of a break if they wanted to buy it. So STA3 is a 30% off coupon. But I think you can get it in other places. Certainly an independent bookseller could get it for you. And, again, we have a Facebook page called Talking Appalachian, and we're about to do a book giveaway on the Facebook page in the coming week. So that would be a good time to like it and follow us.
Well, that sounds like good advice. Everyone should like this book. It's very likable. They might even get a free one. That's excellent. I'd also recommend for writing projects who are interested in language and language diversity that maybe they'd like to order sets of these books and have a book group or a book study around this book because it's so rich and powerful and really interesting. There's so much in it to talk about. So
that would be wonderful.
We'll make sure everybody has the link. We'll find a link and make sure people can find it easily and have the code so they can get 30% off. Thank you, Amy.
Okay, thank you.
And thanks again for being a guest on T Radio. It's been fantastic to talk to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.